So, good evening. I'm Ron Kagan, the director of the Zoological Society. Thank you. Thank you. We're all here because of our shared passion about animals and the welfare of animals. And in a moment, I get to introduce somebody to you who I think has an amazing intellect and an amazing heart, especially, but not just, on behalf of animals. But first, in 2003, the Detroit Zoological Society realized that despite our best intentions and our best efforts, elephants could not thrive here. And in 2005, we were able to send Wanda and Winky to the Performing Animal Welfare Society Sanctuary in California. PAWS was founded in 1984, is that right? 84, 85? To protect and rescue abandoned and abused and retired performing animals and to give them an incredible home. I have worked with PAWS almost since the beginning and have been really, really excited that they were going to come here for the symposium that we've held today and will be holding tomorrow. So while we have lots of incredible people in the audience, we have Congressman Gary Peters, we have Cal Morgan from the Humane Society, we have scientists from all over the world, we have zoo leaders from all over the country. Tonight, I want to recognize PAWS for their incredible commitment and care of our elephants and other elephants and thousands of other animals. And I'd like to share with you, and since I bet you don't want to come up here, I'm going to come to you. This is the first ever Berla Award that the Detroit Zoological Society and the Center for Zoo Animal Welfare are giving to you for your extraordinary advancement of captive exotic animal welfare. So Pat and Ed, we love you and we think you are really extraordinary and we thank you. Please join me in applause.
Worth the trip.
So I will just, for those of you that don't know, Berla was a polar bear in a circus. And we were fortunate enough to be able to rescue Berla in 2002. She then went on to have a cub here, Tellini. And you can see them when you come to the Arctic Ring of Life. But anyway, congratulations. There are going to be a lot of recurring themes. Part of the reason for that is that they're important. And we have to keep finding our way here. But I think you can see why we asked Ken to help us with our advisory board. And you know, we know everybody in this room. We don't know all of you personally, but we know your work, and this is really an incredible foundation for us to make a lot of progress. So we now know that sheep can individually recognize the faces of at least 50 other sheep. Why would they be able to do that? So there is individuality in sheep. And should we be surprised by that? Probably many of us in the zoo community assume a zebra is a zebra is a zebra. But we would not assume that every gorilla has the same thoughts or emotions, nor should we have assumed this for zebra. We're trapped. we don't easily see a difference. So we're trapped with our own sensory limitations and with a kind of species arrogance. It's almost certain that there is such a thing as individuality in many, many species, what we call personality, and as Ken mentioned. It may be very different than individuality in humans. Our animals are not biological robots. They are individuals. Early this year, we hosted a symposium with our colleagues from Michigan State University. We compared farm animal welfare science and zoo animal welfare science, a very valuable experience. Our symposium this weekend is really just about zoo animal welfare, the science, and also the policy. What is our reality in the zoo world? I'd like to tee up some of the challenges for us and perhaps more importantly for the animals. How do we understand and address exotic animal welfare? That question challenged us to create this Center for Zoo Animal Welfare. So I want to quickly share a little bit about who we are and why we're now here with you. Like any other modern zoo, we've built lots of wonderful exhibits at this zoo. Things like the Arctic Ring of Life, the country's largest polar bear environment. It was developed 10 years ago with the express purpose of addressing the welfare needs of captive bears, a group of animals that are particularly challenging in zoos. We also developed at that time, and sort of as an example of zoos becoming a little less unilaterally focused on the charismatic megavertebrates, the National Amphibian Conservation Center. Yes, we worry about the welfare of frogs. This amphibian initiative was and remains a multi-million-dollar investment. It illustrates the point that we don't think welfare or conservation initiatives should be run like a beauty contest. There is a lot of exhibit evolution within the zoo community, not just here, not just in the US, but also abroad. And many, many exhibits are now much larger, much more complex, and much better. For this institution, animal welfare became a priority about 20 years ago. We first got involved with exotic animal rescues, starting out with Katie, the crack house lion. She was on guard duty in the basement of a crack house in Detroit. Last year, we rescued three more lions from a junkyard in Kansas. There have been other lions too, and some of those now live at the Paws Sanctuary in California. Pat and Ed are right there. Earlier, we had worked on an ex-Hollywood, then roadside zoo orangutan rescue. Then there was a gorilla rescue, a gorilla living in a shopping mall in Tacoma, Washington. After years of struggle, our distinguished colleague, Terry Maple, gave a home to Ivan at the Atlanta Zoo. You know, 20 years ago, when you dug into things like this, you sometimes found that some of these exotic animals' origins were from the zoo community. That was troubling. But values change, and that paradigm has changed. For years, we've partnered with the Michigan Humane Society and other welfare and humane groups. We've rescued racehorses, circus bears, and now we host the largest remote pet adoption events in the nation. We developed the Wildlife Interpretive Gallery, a unique place that explores the relationship between humans and animals. We produced a film series that explores this relationship, and one of those films, an Emmy award-winning film, was narrated by James Earl Jones, and it covered the challenges of animal well-being in the various forms of entertainment. We also became the first zoo some years ago approved as a sanctuary. And we became the first zoo to create a position of director of animal welfare. It was important to us to explicitly communicate that we aren't just advancing conservation or animal care, but also animal welfare. We helped create the first zoo simulator, which you will experience later today, an intriguing way for people to see the world through the eyes of animals. This can be a first step to a better understanding of their experience. You know, it's hard enough to think of what it's like to be another person never mind another species. And as I mentioned earlier, 10 years ago, we hosted Animal Welfare 911. We felt there was an urgency, actually an emergency, within the zoological community about this, hence we called it Animal Welfare 911. We then created the Academy for Humane Education and helped to create legislation that bans the ownership of exotic animals, private ownership. Then also, as Ken referenced, we made an important and some would say controversial decision to stop holding elephants. We decided that their physical and social needs probably could not be met here. Then we created a humane science lab, which you'll also see later today, this center for zoo animal welfare. And last year we assisted with the largest exotic animal rescue ever in the United States in partnership with HSUS and PETA. Over 27,000 animals' lives were at stake. So we have some history thinking about this animal welfare issue and wondering whether captive exotic animals have a good life. And as an organization that is clearly focused on the paradigm of good to great, we ask ourselves, and now you, how do we ensure that good care results in happy? What a scary word. Not just healthy lives. It's important to recognize some fundamental similarities as well as differences between exotic and domestic animal welfare. Domestic animals have been bred specifically to live with humans. This obviously reduces the stress for them. Exotic animals have not. So we ask ourselves, are zoo animals thriving or are they just surviving? And the starting point is obviously that zoos mean well, are filled with incredible people who are devoted, caring, skilled, and trained. But is that enough? Not in the world of medicine. About 10 years ago, pioneers in medicine recognized and acknowledged that there were unintended and not insignificant consequences of some hospitalizations. Some people go to hospitals, this has been very well documented and published, and they come out more sick or they die. Obviously, the physicians and nurses are only there to help, and all are very knowledgeable, but good intentions and training do not always guarantee desired results. And we must understand what is happening. We should think of this as quality control. We in the zoo community do a lot of conservation work. That's species welfare, not animal welfare. We know that most zoo animals live longer than their wild counterparts, and most reproduce reasonably well. Historically in our profession, we measured and bestowed awards for things like breeding and longevity. We kind of thought those were indicators of well-being. We considered ourselves to be doing a good job if animals were reproducing and living long lives. But we now know that this is not really the measure of well-being. It's not hard to imagine that if we put men and women together in a prison, they could live long lives and they could reproduce. So what is our problem? Well, like many other professions, there are traditions and lots of assumptions. These can lead to overconfidence, believing that all is well. Another problem is that there is very little training specifically in zoo animal welfare. There are only a few positions that I know of in the U.S. Zoo community that are animal welfare specialists. One could argue that our enrichment efforts confirm that we know that zoo animals are challenged. Enrichment is an acknowledgement of the need for us to compensate for unsatisfactory physical and/or social environments. Some realize that if our assumptions have been wrong all these years about how zoo animals are faring, the implications could be significant. The economic implications of addressing farm animal welfare issues in commercial agribusiness are enormous. It may be no different for the zoo community. In order to develop a wonderful captive environment for polar bears, we spent $15 million for just a few bears. The new elephant facilities that are being developed in several places around the country are costing as much as $40 million each for just a few animals. So the financial repercussions, if fundamental change is needed, could be very significant, and this may be an unstated obstacle to progress. The challenges for zoo animals should really be pretty obvious to us. The captive environment is limiting. One can make the case that a captive exotic animal is not exactly the same as a wild animal, depending on where it was born and its history. But how to make captivity similar to the wild, unpredictable and dynamic, is why enrichment is critical. To constantly try to change what is happening in the physical and social environment is crucial. We cringe when the public notices animals that appear to be bored. That's, of course, a very subjective assessment, unless you measure it scientifically. We now have the knowledge and the tools to assess well-being. What must it be like, let's say, for an antelope in a holding building? Why, we go in every day and do what we need to do. To make sure these areas are clean, we use all sorts of aromatic, even noxious chemicals. Given the olfactory sensitivity of most mammals relative to our own, this must be incredibly overpowering at times. How about when we're closing shift doors, banging away and doing all sorts of things that unintentionally create loud noises? One has to assume that for a lot of animals, that could be frightening and stressful. These are just a few unintended consequences of caring for zoo animals. They are forced to be near us. It's unlikely they'd choose to do that on their own. So in terms of advancing the science of zoo animal welfare, we have a really big challenge. Unlike the farm animal welfare scientific community, our sample sizes are really small. Most zoos have less than 10 of anything in one place. It's harder to do meaningful research because of the sample size. We also have tremendous variability between zoos. Their particular climate, care protocols, housing conditions, exhibit layout, all different. And we're not dealing with just five or six species, as in the farm animal welfare community. We have hundreds of species. So our baseline knowledge right now is extremely limited, and much of it is anecdotal. That's one of the things that has to change. The science within the zoo community, specifically animal welfare science, has to catch up. We need to document what the situation actually is, as scary as that might be. An enormous amount of assessment needs to happen. Now, more work is going on in the U.S., in Europe than in the U.S., but fortunately, in the past 10 years, there has also been significant work in the U.S. I mentioned before a little bit about some variables like smell and sound. There are very, very few studies within the zoo environment where climate is looked at in terms of animal welfare. This is potentially a huge issue. 20 or 30 years ago, polar bears would be found in zoos in Texas. These days, it's pretty clear that would be problematic. Surely some captive exotics are currently challenged where they are now by compromises of mismatched physical environments, including climate. Another challenge revolves around the need to keep animals in locomotion appropriate environments. How many zoo birds can actually fly? As another example of our complicated paradigm, we tend to insist that environments are clean. Some animals probably don't appreciate that, like hippos in water. Some captive animals may live on substrates that prevent their natural behavior. An anteater digs for a living. What happens if it lives on a hard gunite surface? One can only assume that would be frustrating. We need to study this. So Ken mentioned this, but one of the most fundamental concerns is really acknowledging and addressing the needs of an animal's natural behavior. Animals need to initiate behaviors. They need to be able to respond and react in their own unique ways. Obviously, animals need the ability to escape. It's a natural tendency for us and for other animals in stressful situations. Zoo animals really can't escape. All this really means that we have a huge responsibility. For an animal to not have meaningful control and meaningful choices and options is the central challenge for zoo animals, and therefore the central challenge for us. But the challenge of providing zoo animals with the ability to make those choices, to initiate behavior, to react to things appropriately, is a huge one. Fundamentally, we make all the choices. We decide who breeds with whom. We decide when you eat, what the texture of the food is. Studies on rats show that having choice is more important than getting a favorite food. While the relative importance of preferences are different in different animals and different species, confounding that ability to express preference, to make choices, is likely a universal obstacle to zoo animal well-being. We must be really frustrating at least some of our animals. I'm hopeful that we'll end up finding out that a lot of what we're doing now is great for the animals, that they are now in a good state of welfare. But currently, there's little evidence that is not anecdotal. We are also trapped with a bit of dated vocabulary in the zoo community. Zoos talk about the animals as a collection. It's kind of awkward to say, but we think and talk about them here as a living resident population. It helps us think about and interact with these living beings, not as objects. Another word distinction: captivity versus confinement. What if some zoo animals are fundamentally in environments that are truly confining? Is that the distinction and the key element that leads to stress? There are a couple of things we just can't do to change the zoo environment. As much as we want to try to provide more choice and control, we're not going to let the animals leave the zoo. And we're not going to let captive predators generally feed on live prey. We're not going to feed gazelles to lions. But that's a welfare concern, of course, for the predators, because that's what they would want to do. So we must be frustrating those natural predators that are captive. There are several species where the issues are truly vexing. With elephants, we wonder. And maybe that's the key. We don't know the answer, but we sure have a question. We wonder why we treat certain species differently. There are places that have killer whales, and killer whales can be quite dangerous, but certainly nobody would consider using discipline on a killer whale, or really anything else in a zoo. Yet elephants can be chained, and they can be hit with an ankus. Nobody would encourage staff to do so, but it's allowed, and obviously the elephants have been taught that an ankus is a threat. They're scared of it. It's tough to argue that human discipline is good for animal welfare. The other thing that is interesting is that we tend to focus on determining what minimum standards are. Why? Why don't we try to determine what optimum standards are? Zoos are unique societal intersections. This is where science, education, values, and public policy all converge. I'm not the first to believe that we say something about ourselves as a species by how we treat others. I think this is the kind of place where we ought to be recognized as compassionate scientists and educators, that animals are not compromised here, but in fact are thriving. And that's because we seek, study, and address potential problems. We do not assume that benevolence and care are enough. We believe that zoos should be both sanctuaries and scientific advancement. All these issues, all these unanswered questions led us to create a path and an infrastructure that we hope will allow progress along this path. And that's what the Center for Zoo Animal Welfare is, and that's why your presence here today is so important to us as, and others as we move ahead. So I want to thank you again for being here, and we are going to take a break now for exactly 10 minutes. I need to caution you, we have 18,000 visitors in the zoo today. If you leave this room, you will be consumed by them. So we strongly encourage you to remain in the building, but we will take now a 10-minute break. And Cynthia, have I forgot any other housekeeping? I guess not. Okay, thank you.